Well, I feel a little spoiled that I got Exodus 15. I hadn't even really looked at it when I was looking at the calendar of when I could be with you. I didn't pick and choose. But when I realized, oh, I got that one, it felt a little bit like a perfect pitch. It's almost like reading a psalm, isn't it? And in fact, some of this language gets picked up and put into the psalms, and we'll look a little bit at some of the psalms today. But where it really took me, for starters, was to the trauma of Exodus, which is a little, if we just were to jump into this song, we might miss the trauma. But if you just kind of go back a chapter and think about what these people have, the people who are singing this song, what they've just been through, it almost makes the singing of the song as much a miracle as what they've just passed through. And I think about our family has been through multiple exoduses. And I think of, and I'm very convicted when I think back on the ways that I have retold that story. And I was thinking back on the retelling of our most, of Ernest and my most recent exodus from Israel, when we crossed the Jordan River, going the opposite direction, out of Israel, just after the war broke out in October. Then I was also thinking about our family's exodus from India when, right as the borders were closing at the start of the pandemic. And I think some of you, I mean, we kind of landed here shortly after that. And so that was very much in the forefront of my mind. And I think of how I have told that story, how I have told the story of sort of being settled into a life and a home that we absolutely loved and a community and vocations, and then realizing that our children needed us back in the States and having to make this hard decision to leave. And then really shortly thereafter, COVID breaking out and things getting shut down all around the world, and so our having sort of begun to think about getting organized to make an international move, but just being about at that point in preparation, and then having 24 hours notice that the borders were indeed closing, and that's how long we had to shut down our home, decide what we keep and what we don't keep, and get on a flight and be on the other side of the world. And that whole story felt very much like a Red Sea crossing, because we were an inch ahead of the crashing waves behind us the whole way. From the very beginning of finding out that our eldest child was just kind of on the verge of life and death, struggling with her mental health, and kind of going, oh my God, are we gonna get there in time? And then realizing we don't know where we're going, we don't know what we're going to be doing, and then realizing, oh, we're leaving right now. And I remember all that night when we realized, oh, we have to go. I mean, we found out about it about 15 minutes before the news broke that the borders were going to close. And so somebody, I don't know how they knew, but one of Ernest's colleagues at the seminary texted, and we're sitting at the dinner table saying, so sorry to hear about the borders closing. And we just kind of like, you know what, we've been watching the news nonstop with this COVID, with the, you know, all the things changing. Let's just eat a nice meal. Let's not get bound up in the news. And finally, we're about three more bites in and said, maybe we should just check that. And so actually, before we even confirmed that that was what was happening, I went ahead and got online and bought tickets, because we knew if this is what is happening in 10 minutes, there will be no available seats on anything left. And so I went ahead and bought tickets on a website that we could cancel for free within 24 hours while Ernest was still confirming it. And true enough, within half an hour, there was nothing available out of India, but we had one-way seats, one-way flight tickets. And then all that night I started packing. And you know, there's that sense of, I don't know where we're going. I don't know what our new life is gonna be. So how do I know what to keep and what to get rid of? What can we afford to ship, and what do we just have to offload? And this wasn't our first time having to do a sudden move like this. And so there's all the old anxiety and the trauma. And I remember through the night, the Lord, I would get bogged down. You know, I'm in a cupboard in the kitchen trying to decide which of these things do I keep. You know, oh, my mother gave me this, or this is my grandmother's, or, you know, and which, hey, it's okay, I can replace it. And I kept getting caught in that indecision of each item. And the Lord, I just kept hearing the Lord in the back of my head, don't get bogged down, don't get bogged down, just keep moving, come on, keep moving, keep moving. And I just heard him saying that all through that night. And it got to the point where he guided me through opening a cabinet with my whole wardrobe and trying to decide, what do I keep, what do I get rid of, you know, what will I want, where are we going to live, what will be usable, what's too precious to give up. And he just started saying to me, just grab what you would buy again. And, you know, pull it out. Don't even go through everything. Don't even sort it all. Just pull it out like you're packing for a trip and leave the rest behind, because that's all, that's what you need to keep doing. And he just kept me calm and focused and moving through that 24-hour period. And I remember reaching the end of it, still wearing the same clothes I'd been wearing 24 hours earlier, and my husband saying, get in the shower, get on your clothes, the taxi's waiting outside, you know, we have a flight to catch. And just that unnerved, and then getting to the airport and just catching the flight, wondering if it even would go, and then being in Dubai, you know, out of India to Dubai, and finding out that this was the last flight that Emirates was taking anywhere in the world, wow, as we were boarding that plane. Oh, and then while we're on that flight, finding out that the state of Illinois, where we were going to be landing, had just shut down. And this was the second state to shut down, you know, late March 2020. Wondering, will they let us out of the airport? The president at the time had said anyone coming through Europe isn't going to be allowed in. They're gonna so we actually went through the Middle East so that we... But it was just one thing after another, and it was just like watching the waves topple, come crashing down, and going, is this going to hit me? Is this the point where I'm going to get stuck behind something and be stuck in the Middle East, stuck in India with a child in America who needs me? Are we going to be stuck in an airport in Chicago? We had friends who knew what we didn't know, that Chicago was shutting down, and so they lived in the city, and they knew we were landing, and they went to the grocery store before everything closed, rented a hotel with a kitchenette, put food in it, dropped their truck off in the Keys, and then got into quarantine. And so when we landed, we were allowed through, and we got to this place. And it was just in the moment, and the way I told that story for a long time, it was a story of trauma. It was a story of, I didn't know, and then we had to leave, and I had to leave this behind, and I was terrified, and I was exhausted, and I was shaking, and, you know, all the dangers, all the unknowns, all the uncertainties. And for a long time, that's how my brain registered that experience. And those are the emotions that got embedded into that memory for me. And the reason I tell all that now is that the children of Israel could have told the story the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, we were at home and things weren't going well, but, you know, at least we had a home. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, we find out, let's go. And we just had to grab what we have and left. And we didn't even have time to really pack or know. And then we're heading through the wilderness, and then the whole army comes after us to slaughter us. And we're just sitting ducks, and we get stuck, you know, we're following this cloud, and we end up next to this border of a sea, and we have no way to go forward, and we can't go backward, and an army is like coming down on us to slaughter our children and us, and we are completely helpless. And then all through the night, this huge windstorm is blowing, and we're out in the dark and the cold and by the ocean, and then it starts opening up, and we're like, oh my goodness, really? We're gonna walk in the middle of all this? I mean, we're looking up on water on either side and just waiting for it to crash in on us, and then we hear it crashing behind us, and we hear the chariot. I mean, this is a trauma story. This is what for the rest of your life you would have triggers about. And it's quite something that just on the other side, Moses says, and Miriam, we're going to stop here and we're going to sing a song. But they don't sing a song of lament. They don't sing a song detailing all the fears and the horrors and the insecurities and their anxiety and all that they've just been through. They sing a song from a different perspective. And often in the moment, we don't have that perspective. We're human. We can't have that perspective. All we see is, am I going to make it? Am I going to make it? How's this going to work out? And there's this brilliance to stopping and singing the song from God's perspective. Because what they sing is something they didn't see happening. They were down and under. Mm-hmm. And instead what they stop is they sing the song from the vision above. of God coming down, of God parting the sea, of God working his wonders. They sing not the song of their experience, but of God's action. And it's an amazing faith song. I don't know if it's a song they could have come up with. They're singing what they didn't see. They're singing the other side of the story. And I think it's actually a gift of the Holy Spirit, and it's not a coincidence that Miriam is referred to as Miriam the prophet in singing this song. It is a spirit-given song to be able to sing from that vision, from that perspective, especially at this point in their experience, to so quickly be able to sing of what God has done. And I think that this is ultimately a song, yes, a song of praise to God, but it's actually a song to embed the memory a certain way. Before they walk away and hold on to this memory of fear and trauma and anxiety and uncertainty, taking the time to stop. And in one author, Trevor Hudson, who's a favorite of mine, talks about developing a Christian memory. Of stopping and saying, okay, let's go back and rehearse the events that we just went through. But instead of rehearsing them as we were seeing them in the moment, let's rehearse them from the way we can actually see them in hindsight, of what God was doing for us. So not I was trapped, I was overwhelmed, I had an army about to slaughter me. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know how I would get there. At any given moment, I thought it was all going to be over. Instead, it's a song of, look at what God did at each point of the way. Look at how he heard our cry. Look at how the night before we left, and I'm speaking of the children of Israel, he had given these instructions for us to prepare a feast, to go ahead and celebrate his deliverance in advance. But on a very practical level, our tummies were already full.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We already had more roasted meat than we could eat that night. That's what we grabbed off the table. We already had unleavened bread that wasn't going to get squished. It was dense and ready for the road, basically the equivalent of water crackers, or better than that, I don't know. But you know what I'm saying? It's like this is a travel meal, already cooked and ready to go, even though we didn't know we were going to be traveling. And God's instructions had been already be dressed.
Mm-hmm.
Have your tunic tucked in, like basically put on your travel clothes to eat this feast. Well, guess what? God had them ready. Everything that they had actually needed to know or do in advance, he had prepared them to do. They didn't need to know the route. They didn't need to know how to cross a sea. They didn't need boats. They didn't need bridges. They didn't need passports or visas. He had all that worked out for them. But what they did need, he had actually prepared them for in advance, even though they may not have realized that's what he was preparing them for. So to be able to look back and sing of what he's done is actually embedding the memory, establishing a right interpretation of their experience, and embedding a different kind of emotion of relief, emotion of safety, an emotion of trust, an emotion of, oh, God saw these things in advance and was already working them out on our behalf. In many ways, this song is the experience of examine. I don't know if many of you are accustomed to praying examine, the examine prayer, maybe at the end of a day. For me, I'm usually already asleep at the end of a day, so it's the first thing the next morning. But pausing before launching into the next season, the next step, just pausing to recollect what happened in the last period of time, the last 24 hours, and not how from the perspective of how I experienced it, but from God's perspective. And so we begin examine by saying, Lord, will you guide me back over the events of this past period of time? And will you show me where you were at work? Because in the moment, I usually miss it. I usually don't see it. And that's not judgment. That's not passing judgment on myself. It's just recognizing I'm me and I see through these eyes, which are down here. But would you show me where you were at work? Where you were involved in internally with me, where you were guiding, where you were nudging, where you were consoling, where you were speaking and moving through and in me, but also where you were at work in the events and the people and the experiences around me. Will you show me? I'd like to go back and meet you in those places, even though I might have been too caught up in the moment to see you then. So we stop, we recollect, and then we celebrate what just happened. Instead of wailing over what just happened, we actually celebrate God's wonders. in a way, it defines the moment that we just experienced, and it ends up defining our relationship with God. And it becomes the launch point from which we can move forward into whatever comes next, because we've settled this period of time rightly in our memory. So songs like this are really, really significant, not just in history, but songs like this are significant in our own life. And I love to use the Psalm of Moses and Miriam, as well as many of the Psalms that we get through the anthology of the Psalms, in my own prayers and moments. These are songs that teach us. Psalm 34 is very along similar lines, and there's this verse that talks about the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers them. And when we read that, when we sing that, it gives us a chance to think about the moments of our distress, when we felt overwhelmed, and it might not be by a sea or a border crossing, it might be by being squeezed between the needs of parents and children, squeezed financially, squeezed in a social situation. But we go back and we notice the ways that the angel of the Lord was there for us and delivered us. And then the psalm later on goes on to say, come my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. And so this Psalm 34 is one of these many teaching psalms, like this one is, of remembering rightly. And what that does is it teaches us, exactly as the very end of chapter 14 in Exodus says, when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. So in going back and rehearsing these things rightly, we learn to fear God rightly, and then to be able to trust him for the future. These are also songs not only that teach us, but songs that rehearse the mighty acts of God. Psalm 107, I mean, there's so many of them, but Psalm 107 has this sort of litany of stories, of scenarios that people were in when they became overwhelmed, and then how God worked out deliverance for them. And it begins by saying, let the redeemed of the Lord tell their story, those he redeemed from the hand of the foe. So it says, some wandered in desert wastelands, and it talks about what happened for them. Some sat in darkness and what happened for them. Some became fools through their rebellious ways and became ill. Some went out into the sea in ships. But all of them, the way the story ends, is having gone through peril and desolation and fear, the Lord met them and delivered them. And again, it says, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. So these moments that could be the events that destroy our ability to trust or to live in the world as if it's a safe place actually become the places where our faith is deepened and our sense of safety is increased, not because there's not peril in the world, but because God has consistently been present to us in our peril and in our moments of anxiety, and in the end delivers. And it's easy to forget that last little bit. These are ultimately songs that define reality. They teach, they rehearse the past, and they define the reality that we're currently living in. And really all the Psalm 90s, there's this sort of theme of our God reigns, right, that runs through those Psalms. 97 was the one really standing out to me. It talks about, says, the Lord reigns, let the earth be glad, let the distant shores rejoice. And as you think about, you know, Exodus 15 and the song by the sea, Psalm 97 says, fire goes before him and consumes his foes on every side. His lightning lights up the world, the earth sees and trembles. It goes on to say, all who worship images are put to shame. Those who boast in idols, worship him, all you gods. And we think about the gods of Egypt that Yahweh has just taken on systematically through the particular plagues that he brought about. And it's a call for those gods even to bow before the one who does reign. And then a little later in Psalm 97, let those who love the Lord hate evil, for he guards the lives of his faithful ones. He delivers them from the hands of the wicked. So it's a celebration. And it's a defining of, oh, actually, this is what the world looks like. And I don't know about you, but in days like these where we're overwhelmed by the news of what's happening in the world, and we don't even know what to think about so much of it. We don't even know who to say is the good guy and the bad guy. Everybody's kind of acting like bad guys, and we also feel sorry for all the people getting hurt in the middle of it. And it's just sort of, it's distressing. Not only do we not have a solution, we don't even have a sense of accurate perspective. And yet, what we are able to say is, over all of this, the same God who can part seas reigns. And it puts the big, scary world in an even bigger perspective of safety. It reminds me of, it's not Teresa of Avila, it's the other one.
Teresa of Lisieux?
No, the hazelnut.
Right. Oh, that
would be Julian of Norwich, with this vision of the hazelnut and living in the middle of a plague, mm-hmm. where people are dying all around her, and everyone's asking, "Why is God angry? What do we need to do to appease Him? Who's next? What guarantee do we have of tomorrow?" And she has this vision of the world being held like a hazelnut in God's hands, mm-hmm. and all shall be well. And it's not that there's not danger and not the reality of plague and war and famine and betrayal even from those that are closest to us, but that all of this exists within the reign of a loving and present God. And so there's this deep safety that comes right in the middle of the same circumstances that would bring on PTSD.
She's the first woman to write in English, by the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's her name again?
Julian of Norwich. Yeah. Yeah.
And she's the first to do
woman to have ever written in English, that we have her writings.
So the importance of the songs that we sing, the songs about our life, the songs that we sing to ourselves, the songs that rehearse what the world is like and what our experience is. These shape and embed our visceral responses to life events. Do we come out trembling and as victims, or do we come out on the other side as well-loved, rescued children? When we sing songs like the children of Israel sang by the sea, and you know, it doesn't fix their problems, but it's just it's almost like God the therapist through his prophet says, okay, this is what you need to sing right now. This is what's going to sustain you in the future. It's a song not about vulnerability, our vulnerability, which is real, but it's a song about God's strength and faithfulness. And in the song, how is God remembered? He's remembered as mine, my God. It's very intimate. He's the God who is, I can call mine, which is a very significant statement to be able to make of people who've never actually seen him. They also call him my father's God. In the second verse, he is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. So there's this sense of rootedness, of history, of something that's continuing, even though our location and our circumstances and so much else has changed. He's named. He's not just God. He's Yahweh. The one who I am, the one who is. And so it makes him personal, makes him knowable. He's a being that's not just a being, but he's given us his name. And he's distinct from the other gods. It's very interesting, in Exodus 15, he's actually personified as, I don't want to overstate this, but there's imagery in Exodus 15 of a sea monster or a dragon, you know, the blast of his nostrils, and there's almost fire that comes out and consumes the enemies like rubble, and the blast of his nostril parts the seas. The same imagery is picked up in Psalm 18, which, interestingly, is a psalm of David, but it also matches the experience of Jonah being in the sea. And it talks about the cords of death entangled me. The anguish of the grave came upon me. I was down in the depths of the sea, and I cried out, and my voice came into God's ear. And he got angry, and he came down, and at the blast of his nostrils, fire actually came out of his nostrils, almost like the imagery of a fire-breathing dragon. And he parted the seas, and he reached down, and he pulled me out and rescued me because he loved me. This imagery may be a little, weird to us, and maybe a little traumatic to think of God as a fire-breathing dragon, But it actually continues this motif of Yahweh against the gods of the lands. So we are just left behind the gods of Egypt, and we're moving into Canaan and all the peoples of this region, and these people all worshipped a sea monster. That was one of their oldest gods. In fact, most of their myths or some variation of the taming of a sea monster, the sea monster being the source of chaos and evil, and this their gods, whether it was Marduk taming Tiamat in the Babylonian myth, or Baal taming Lotan or Tanin is another version of the Leviathan in Canaanite mythology. But there were all these stories of a sea monster that's trying to destroy humanity, and some god comes in and tames it, and, well, not just tames it, kills it. And that's how humans are able to live on the earth. So there's this motif going on, and it's almost preparing the people that when you enter this new land that's going to have a new set of gods that are said to control the harvest and fertility and life on the earth, guess which god tamed the sea monster? It's the same one who tamed the gods of Egypt. He rules over the sea, and he rules over the land that you're about to enter. So wherever you go, you're in his territory. Wherever you go, known or unknown to you, you're under his care. And this is just so significant, this motif in the very middle of the song. Who among the gods is like you, Lord? Who is like you in majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? And this is this constant appeal to our hearts, to their hearts and to ours. Who is your God? Not just what is he like, but is he really the one you can rely on in this circumstance, in politics, in finance, in relationships, in all these different sort of areas where we think, well, that's apart from God. Here's where we have to employ a different set of strategies and rules to make it. No, in all of them, in all terrains, God reigns. I want to know the time. Okay, I should stop.
You're good.
Okay, well, I'm going to skip over a few things. No? What?
No.
It begins to foreshadow that the earth will open and swallow. I mean, you see, it talks about the language of the earth will swallow your enemies. And that's actually going to happen to some of the Israelites when Korah, Nathan, and Abiram speak out against God's anointed. They're going to see the earth swallow and remember, oh, wait, we sang about that. This is what happens when we don't fear and honor this God. The nations will hear and actually not just not attack us, but Rahab, is the prostitute in the city of Jericho, is going to say to the spies when they come, guess, you know why, then they ask, why are you helping us? And she's going to say, we heard about what your God did in Egypt and what he did for you crossing that sea, and we're terrified. So I've come to believe in your God, and I'm actually, even though I'm being a traitor to my people, I'm trusting your God, and I know he's going to win. So the nations will hear and help. And as the song sings, they will be still as stone as we pass right through their lands, when they really are way bigger and better fortified than we are. We're going to be able to pass in safety because our God reigns. And this is the good news. And it's right there at the in verse 18 of this chapter. The Lord reigns forever and ever. We rehearse who won the day so that we can live as if God is good at his job. This is one of my life projects. To actually live each moment and each day as if God is good at his job. Which sounds so disrespectful, but actually, in any given moment, I kind of forget that and think I've kind of got to compensate for him a little bit. You know, I've got to manage this. And when I take on management, it doesn't really go well. My methods are less holy, less loving. They come out of anxiety and not out of peace and trust that he is actively reigning. So singing these songs establishes our faith, which actually gives way to obedience and ultimately makes room for us to love, to be the people that we intend to be in the world because we know he's reigning on our behalf. Of course, we'll be vulnerable again. We'll come up on seas and on armies again, but we can rely on him to repeat his wonders then as he has now. This good news, your God reigns, is actually the motif that Isaiah the prophet picks up when he talks about, when he says, how beautiful on the feet, on the mountains are the feet of those who bring the good news. And the imagery is of a besieged city thinking that they're about to be done in. So once again, a people under stress, under anxiety, in the face of danger. And the messenger shows up saying, hey, guess what? Your God has won the day. I used to wonder, how is this the gospel? Because this is the gospel that Paul refers to in Romans when he says, how will they call on the one they've not believed in? How can they hear without a preacher? Paul references Isaiah's verse of how beautiful are the feet. And it's kind of this throwback to the motif of your God reigns, which is the message through the Psalms. If our God reigns, then the world is a perfectly safe place to be. If our God reigns in the midst of war, in the midst of conflict, in the midst of deprivation, all will be well. All things will probably be well. Because he's holding on to it for us. The way we rehearse this story to ourselves determines the way we tell it to other people. And so it starts with rehearsing it to ourselves and singing to ourselves the song rightly, because that's how it comes out. I've been convicted of the way I've told the story of our crossings, of a poor me story rather than a look at what God did for us story. Look at how he provided. Look at how he forewarned us. Look at how he guided us each step of the way. Look at the fact that we did get the ticket, that we did make it on the flight. Look at the fact that the next flight did go, that we were allowed through the airport, that friends had our back and were providing for us in advance when we didn't even know we needed it. Look at the fact that our daughter is now thriving and living under our roof. And, you know, it just, you have to kind of go back and go, oh, this is the story. This is the song. The story of Exodus, and this is the last thing I'll leave you with, the story of the Exodus really is the story of the people of God. We've been led out of our captivity to sin. And really, sin is whatever separates us, rather than in perception or in reality, whatever separates us from the love of God. If it can separate us in our perception of his present help, then we'll act as if that's so. And that's what we do that is sin. We've been delivered from that captivity, led through the waters of baptism, through the river, through the sea, which feels like a death, and it is, led out the other side into newness of life. And yet this newness of life isn't the end of the story. Just as for the children of Israel, it's not going to be the end of the story. It's a pause. We look back and we celebrate, but they're actually just now setting out into 40 years of trial by fire. 40 years, though, that could be sung that way as a lament. Oh, we lived in the desert. We never knew when we'd have water. We never knew when we'd have food. We didn't have homes. And yet it's also going to be a story of God's provision, of God meeting them every step of the way. So they get to practice now how they're going to keep telling the story, how they're going to keep recording it. And that's us. We reemerge to resurrection, to newness of life, to walk with Christ through the wilderness of our lives. But it's a wilderness that, as this song tells us in the end, takes us somewhere. You will bring them in and plant them on the mountain of your inheritance, the place, Yahweh, you made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, Lord, your hands established. And we're still on our wilderness wanderings, being led by the hand of God, but being led to our future destination. And so we stop along the way for celebration, to seal our memory of the past, to redefine our experience of the present, and to foreshadow the celebration song of heaven, when we will sing to the Lord who has triumphed gloriously. Mm-hmm. And we will look back and see all the horse and riders that he has thrown into the sea.